Have you ever wondered how some people have been able to square their consciences to survive and sometimes even thrive in the worst regimes? That inspired Hannah Arendt's study of Adolf Eichmann during his trial in 1961 and Gita Sereny's on Albert Speer. Wendell Stevenson has done something similar with Kamal Sachet. I hope I'm pronouncing the name
Kamal
right.
Kamal Sachet.
Sachet? Oh,
yeah,
it's...
Yeah, exactly like it's written.
I just assumed that it was that weird thing that happens when you translate.
Transliterating
Arabic
is never an easy thing.
Kamal Sachet, who is a Ba'athist general and military hero who fell in and out of favor under Saddam Hussein's system of capricious rule. The book, The Weight of a Mustard Seed, An Iraqi General's Moral Journey During the Time of Saddam, is published by Collins. I'm very pleased that it has brought Ms. Stevenson to the show today.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You covered it as a freelance journalist for the London Observer. Arrived how soon after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq?
Well, I was in the north in Kurdistan during the invasion. I got down to Baghdad about a week after that, kind of exhausted looking at the sort of mess and detritus of what had happened, and then went home, recovered a little bit, and went back that summer. So I was there in August. And then pretty much continually from that autumn to the middle of 2004, and then back again a little bit in the early 2005.
You left just to feel a little more safe at times, because you do describe how much danger you always felt you were in.
Well, after the war, there was a lot of gunfire and rat-a-tat and confusion and explosions and so forth. But it seemed like this might be initially the sort of teething problems and the hangover, and that it would settle down. But that was not the case. And I was there sort of continually for a big stretch for about 6 or 8 months through till the middle of 2004, as I said. And what happened was that the violence kind of crept incrementally, so you didn't realize it was getting so much worse. And towards the end of that time, I remember I had become really exhausted and just... couldn't concentrate anymore, wasn't kind of tracking, wasn't able to pay attention. I remember going out for a week to Dubai, and I'd almost forgotten that there was a world outside, you know, that you could walk down a street. Or I remember walking out onto the beach the first day I arrived and just being totally shocked by normality.
Because you say, in Iraq, I always wore a big black tent, abaya, as disguise in the back of the car, texted my whereabouts to a friend every hour, and took care never to walk down the street.
Yeah, that was when I went back for about 6 weeks in early 2005, during the time of the first kind of, if you remember, the Indigo Finger elections. And at that point, it had really disintegrated. The security situation was atrocious. You couldn't, I would say about 70% of Baghdad was absolutely impassable. You couldn't really drive into neighborhoods. They were totally insurgent controlled. The violence was everywhere all the time. Crossfire would come at you from several different directions. There was no way to hedge your risk. There was no way to be clever anymore about who you were with or where you were going. It was just a risk every time you stepped outside the hotel. And even in the hotel, you know, we woke up. It was sort of like car bombs, like alarm clocks at 8 a.m. in the morning.
Well, you were in a hotel where there were other journalists, I assume.
Yeah.
And made you a target.
Yeah, and we were bombed. In fact, the second day I was there, blew out half the windows of the hotel.
In the prologue, you write of meeting Dr. Hassan, a psychiatrist who studied in Munich and London, and he had just been robbed.
Yeah, this was the summer after the war, and there was a lot of robbing and kidnapping and score settling, and it was just basic lawlessness. You know, the police were off the streets or gone. The Americans hadn't really imposed themselves in an everyday kind of quotidian way, in a low to the ground way, and so it was just opportunistic.
Had life been better for him under Saddam?
Yeah, he'd been, you know, part of the urban professional middle classes. He was a general in the medical corps of the army. He had a private practice. He, you know, had status and money and a house, and he was doing fine.
And had he thought much about the whole matter of the relationship between oppressor and oppressed? Because he is a psychiatrist.
Absolutely. And that's why when I was first there, when I was trying to sort of think and figure out and talk to people, what happened here, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years? Because it was so shut in and so closed off. For me, it was sort of a privilege. It was like being able to kind of walk around and ask people in Berlin in 1945, or imagine that you could be in Moscow in 1937 or whatever. And you know, those closed societies that you, where people are too afraid to talk, have been shut off from us. And here was an opportunity to say what happened here, what was going on, and how are people living?
Well, these are people who I'm sure thought of themselves as decent, and who wound up doing some pretty awful things.
Mm. Well, psychiatrists were interesting because they were a sort of window into this world, and they had a bit of perspective, and they spoke English. A lot of them had studied or worked abroad. And so they were my sort of first point of contact in trying to understand a little bit about the kind of psychology and pathologies of Iraqi society in particular, their friends, their milieu, and in specifics.
Another psychologist you spoke to, Dr. Laith, who'd worked for the Ba'ath Party, says, it was as if I had two or more personalities. I would do my best as an officer with my duties, and then I would come home and speak against the regime. All Iraqis have two or more characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was interesting to me because he had left Iraq, actually, kind of recused himself, managed to extricate himself from the Ba'athis and from Iraq itself in the mid-90s. And so he was able to articulate this duplicity, this duality that I think that a lot of Iraqis existed under, but were less aware of. You know, these kind of dualities get merged. And he had separated them and understood the kind of the before and after, the Ba'athi facade, the interior moral conscience.
Do you think this is common in all totalitarian regimes?
Where you
can't say what you really think. In fact, in some cases, you're going to lose your job if you even offer the slightest dissidence.
Yeah, I suspect it is to a large extent. There's a public face, there's a public facade. There are certain red lines that you know when not to cross, things not to question. And there's also a kind of a blinkering denial process of not wanting to really look in the corners or look behind the door or the curtain or the shadow, into the shadow, not to ask questions that you are frightened of the answer of. But I think Saddam's Iraq was different from your kind of bog standard dictatorship in the sense that the violence and the terror was so extreme, the consequences of stepping out of line were so brutal that level of inculcated fear was really off the charts, because you could really see the sort of psychological effects of people having to live with that level of genuine terror. It became kind of, you know, a sort of a social paranoia.
You write, I'm quoting, "At the back of my mind in every interview I ever conducted with Iraqis was the knowledge that duplicity was as much a part of being Iraqi as excessive pride, excessive hospitality, and love of the kebab." That duplicity continued after the fall of Saddam?
Well, I labored quite a lot over the sentence because it's harsh, you know, and I talked to Iraqi friends and I said, you know, is this too much? Am I pushing too far? Is this too mean? And it's funny that my Western friends and, you know, fellow correspondents thought it was a little bit too harsh, but my Iraqi friends quite often were like, actually, that's kind of spot on, rather ruefully. I think, it, you know, again, it's this this idea of the kind of public face and the internal questions that are the public-private thing that is never really reconciled. And learning how to navigate that system, who you should butter up, what kind of face you present to whom at which time. And I think often in their dealings with the Americans, you know, Iraqis were well-trained and understood, you know, what to say when, how to respond to them in order to kind of get out of the situation that they were in or to get the most out of the situation they found themselves in.
But how did that apply with you? After all, you are a journalist and you're asking them some pretty tough questions. You have to assume that they're putting their best face forward.
Absolutely,
aren't they?
They're putting and often dissembling and often evading. But I think what was interesting to me is that I was telling an Iraqi story, and what I wanted to tell it from an Iraqi perspective within an Iraqi context. And all the people, I mean, there were people who didn't want to talk to me at all, but the people who did were happy to have that story told and wanted that story told.
My guest is Wendell Stevenson. Her book, The Weight of a Mustard Seed, An Iraqi General's Moral Journey During the Time of Saddam, published by Collins. And let's talk about that Iraqi general. Dr. Hassan was the one who told you to see the family of General Kamal Sachet. Why did he believe that he would be a good subject for your book?
Well, he was a good friend of Kamal Sachid's, and they had, and he was a good friend of his because they had been in jail together in the early 80s, and quite by chance they had found themselves sharing a jail cell in a VIP jail. They'd both fallen foul of the regime for sort of minor infractions. Kamal Sachid made a comment over a telephone that he didn't like a certain military order or retreat. And Dr. Hassan was meeting with too many other of his Shia friends, and that was deemed dangerous.
So Kamal Sachid objected to the invasion of Kuwait. That got him in trouble.
He didn't know about the invasion of Kuwait. He objected to the retreat from Kuwait. He was upset and appalled by the invasion. By then, it was moot, and he could only sort of do his duty and do what he was told and follow orders to a certain extent. But after that, the scale of the defeat and really shocked him, and the effects of that misadventure on the army and on Iraq made him very angry. But he certainly didn't voice those emotions. He managed to sort of briefly get himself out of the army and retired for a few months before Saddam kind of remembered that he was there and hauled him back to be governor of a province. But he certainly didn't go on the record as denouncing that.
So was that typical during Saddam's regime, that he would throw somebody in prison one day and then bring him back and make him governor of a province?
It was very typical, and that was one of the really curious things to me, to understand why, if you had seen the other side of the regime, you'd seen the consequences and how base and capricious and arbitrary this was, and how even if you played by the rules and were upstanding and obedient and dutiful and nodded and joined the Ba'ath Party, even then you could be punished. That they didn't just sort of see the facade and the awfulness for what it was and try and get out of it. But it was this very odd dynamic of punishing and then rewarding and then bringing back into the fold. And once they had been reabsorbed, possibly promoted, you know, Saddam was very big on gifts of cash and land and cars and, you know, things that you should, particularly in Arab society or any, you know, be grateful to your patron for, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they were really, I think, morally and, you know, compromised by this.
After the invasion, there was a de-Ba'athification process, and people like General Sachet were pretty much told to that they were no longer wanted. Would he have been a good candidate for helping in the transition?
It's tricky. I mean, Kamal Sachit was executed in 98, and so we'll never know. I don't think, given he became increasingly religious, quite extremely religious, I think, as a result of his kind of moral quandary with the regime. It was a kind of moral retrenchment. And so I think he would have found an American invasion, a foreign invasion of his country, quite difficult to stomach. And certainly his sons did.
And when you went to his family, what was their reaction to the idea that you might write a book about him?
Well, they were very happy to talk to me about their father because they, you know, revered him as a brave man, as a sort of martyr, as their... that his, you know, he was a good man who tried to do the right thing, who'd suffered, who'd stood up, he was a hero. And so they were pretty happy to talk about that. And also when I first met them, it was just after the invasion and when everything was very unclear. And we had this sort of relationship when I was asking them, what is Iraq? What are you doing? What happened here? How do you live? What's going on? What do you think? And they were asking me the same kind of questions. You know, what are you doing here? What do we do with the Americans? This is a bit strange. Why is this happening? And so we sort of became friends, really, in that time, which was easier. It then became much harder. The last time I saw them, you know, the insurgency was in full swing. It was pretty clear to me that the sons had joined that insurgency. And they weren't interested in my point of view anymore. And certainly if I'd met them then, they never would have talked to me.
Would they have joined the insurgency because they subscribed to the Ba'athist ideology?
To the Ba'athist ideology. I think least of all Saddam, you know, at the end.
Because an interesting thing about Ba'athism. You have Syrian Ba'athist government and you had an Iraqi Ba'athist government.
Yeah, and
they had very little in common other than the name.
Not a lot of love lost between them at all. No, I mean, the sort of basic tenets of nationalism, socialism, pan-Arabism, that had been popular and exciting, why lots of people joined in the 60s and 70s when these revolutions in Syria and Iraq were happening, had pretty much, you know, totally atrophied under you know, complete totalitarian rule. And all those ideologies just become subject to Saddam's will. So Baathism as an ideology is long dead and long buried. And I don't think that there were... I mean, I almost never came across anybody in Iraq who was loyal to Saddam or Baathism. I mean, one or two, you know, kind of hangover nutcases.
But, so this is different than being a true believing Nazi, for example.
Yeah, no, totally. This was about, you know, I think for the Sachet sons, being part of the insurgency was about resisting an occupier, was about standing up for your religion, opposing the, you know, the oppressor or the infidel, partly religious, partly nationalistic.
What would General Sachet have done during a typical day? Do we know? Did his family know what he was doing?
A typical day. Well, during war, he worked his way up through the ranks to become a general during the Iran-Iraq War, and then he was often away and at the front. And so
but was he responsible for any of the more egregious acts of the Hussein regime?
Yeah, I tried to look into this, and I spent quite a lot of time in Kurdistan talking to Kurds and stuff, whether he'd been involved in the nasty attacks and the Anfal campaign against the Kurds, and I never found any direct connection with that. Having said that, you know, he was a general in the Iraq army, and I know that he was a commander in battles when gas was used against the Iranians. He was in the special forces, so it wasn't kind of his department, if you like, that was loading artillery shells with sarin gas, but he was certainly in battles where that was deployed.
We're told often that one of the most difficult aspects of reporting on life under Saddam is that it's virtually impossible to corroborate the stories that you're told.
Yeah. No, absolutely. This was a kind of piecing together a jigsaw of oral history. There's sort of almost nothing you can read. And, you know, in people's memories, it's 20 or 30 years ago. Sometimes you're trying to get them to recollect, and people's memories are inevitably self-serving and elliptical. But I tried as much as possible. And this is what happens. You get a sense, you know, when you get into your subject and you know what's likely, what's real, and you cross-reference. So somebody says, you know, mentions this incident or that incident, and then there's a couple of pictures or whatever, and then it sort of suddenly makes sense that that really, really did happen.
You interviewed a number of people who committed horrific acts, and you tried not to pass judgment on them. Was that important? If they had felt that you were judging them, might they not have been as open with you?
Well, I'm a reporter, so your job is to ask questions and listen to the answer. The judgment is for courts and priests and imams and family members and victims. It's a different relationship. And certainly you have to ask the difficult questions sometimes, like, wasn't that wrong? Didn't you think that was wrong? Why did you do that?
Well, do you feel that most of them felt justified in what they had done, or did they regret that they had been part of this whole thing?
Very difficult to get them to look you straight in the eye and admit or regret in a sort of hands-up moment of culpability. There were a lot of excuses, there were evasions, and there were justifications. And the justifications were sometimes a bit rote, but sometimes quite well thought through. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to have not to have some sympathy with the I was just following orders defense, which, while being kind of weak and lame and rather off-trotted out, at the same time, the consequences for not following orders were death.
My guest is Wendell Stevenson, who's written a book called The Weight of a Mustard Seed, An Iraqi General's Moral Journey During the Time of Saddam. It's published by Collins. But we have your title here as an important factor in the whole thing. The Weight of a Mustard Seed comes from a Quranic verse about the scales of justice on which every soul is weighed. And unless these people had no sense of religion, they had to come to grips with the fact that what they were doing went against their own belief system, went against the Quran.
I think there was definitely a movement in Iraq, as in a lot of Arab countries, during the 80s and 90s to sort of move into religion more seriously and to pray and take the kind of the time to pay attention to the specifics of the religion. I think before that, Islam had occupied a kind of a more general cultural space. And the weight of a mustard seed is a phrase that means the idea that when you come before your maker, all your deeds will be judged, the good and bad and all the gray areas, even if they're as small as the weight of a mustard seed.
Well, there are plenty of mustard seeds in these guys' lives.
And Kamal Satchard, I think, tried very hard to do good deeds, to kind of get up his credit rating, as it were, and count, just like sort of prayers are counted in quite a literal way by some Muslims, that this was part of it.
Is there a challenge in trying to explain to people who live in free societies what it's like to live in a dictatorship of this
Yeah,
sort?
Absolutely. I think that's also the really important to understand the kind of general context that people were living in. And for Iraqis and for people like General Kamal Satchet, it wasn't just that they were living in a totalitarian state, but they're also living in an Arab Islamic state, which has different kind of codes and norms about obedience and how you interact socially.
And they were also living in a state where a Sunni minority was pretty much controlling a Shiite majority. And
yeah.
They felt that they had to keep order. In the course of writing this book, do you feel as though you've located the line between the forced complicity of some and the conscious evil of high-ranking believers?
I kind of... No. It's undefinable. Because each act, each moment of violence or brutality or nastiness, menace, happens in its own context, in its own environment, in its own split second, can be a reaction, can be the culmination of a lot of things. And so I shy away from almost labeling anything evil, not to say that there aren't bad people who do bad things. But the word evil, I think, is too pejorative. You have to make some attempt not to deny the badness of it, but to understand why or how this came about.
But there are sadistic people in the world.
Yeah, there are.
And who take pleasure from hurting others.
Yes, there are.
And
we
see
and
that in all societies, not just in repressive regimes.
And when they find themselves in, you know, in positions of authority in intelligence services, the results are not pretty.
Or if we see things like Abu Ghraib.
Well, what's interesting, one of the people that I read for the book and that I cite is Philip Zimbardo, who's a psychologist mm-hmm. who's done
He's
a lot of...
He's been on the show any number of times.
You know, fascinating guy. He's done a lot of work with looking at the context of brutality of authority figures inside prisons and so forth, and how it's the context of that kind of disproportion between authority and obedience and how this kind of structure within a prison that creates the environment for that. And that the guards who seemed to be the most brutal, you couldn't possibly have guessed that was going to happen, display no signs of that in any other walk of their life, are not generally sadists in inverted commas, that it's the structure of that environment that somehow encouraged that excess or that behavior.
What's happened to these people? Were the psychologists, psychiatrists able to continue practicing?
Dr. Hassan is, I think, now in Abu Dhabi. It's difficult for Iraqis to, they have some kind of, I mean, all Iraqis in exile now have, which are, there are millions of them, have complications with visas and qualifications and getting jobs and money, but he's basically okay. I mean, I think that generally a lot of that upper echelon had a bit of money salted away and had well-connected family members and relatives, and a lot of them have managed to be all right, but some much less so.
Well, I would think this is a country that needs a lot of psychologists, because you describe Iraq as traumatized and disintegrating, caught between the coalition forces and psychotic terrorists. Maybe that'll change with changes in policy, but...
I think it's a little bit of a paraphrase. I think that there's no doubt that this is a society that has gone through 20 or 30 years or more of war and repression, of really extreme and excoriating nature. And there's no doubt that the bonds of community, law, civil partnership, citizenship, these concepts have really disintegrated and broken down in obvious ways. I remember one of the things I couldn't understand after the war was that there was this kidnap epidemic in Baghdad. And, they were just... by epidemic, I mean, you know, thousands of children and women were being kidnapped by local gangs sometimes killed, sometimes raped, sometimes handed back for ransoms.
And you're blonde and blue-eyed.
That makes me a political target. This was just general for cash kidnapping. And I thought, you know, in any given society, how many kidnappers can there be? How can you suddenly, it's not just a function of it being lawless and there having not enough police. There has to be enough people willing to do that. It seemed very odd to me that the lawlessness engendered that degree of criminality.
But it's also led, I'm sure, to something the equivalent of what soldiers experience, post-traumatic stress disorder. There was an article in yesterday's New York Times that mentioned that women have a lot of depression and PTSD because they have borne the brunt of keeping families together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's very hard to, I think, also for women in that society to be left alone or abandoned, or because you're also sort of slightly helpless. So you're dependent on male relatives for a sort of social support structure. And if that disappears, you can be very vulnerable.
Were women complicit in all of these horrors, or is this pretty much a male thing?
I don't want to sort of deny women's role in society, but it was pretty much a male thing. I mean, you're talking
about...
But
we do have Lady Macbeth saying, go to it, perhaps.
Perhaps. Was Sajida encouraging Saddam? Is this where it all came from, his need to prove his masculinity to her? I don't know. It's a stretch, maybe. No, this seemed to be the sort of extreme perversion of a kind of tribal society, you know, that Saddam set himself up as sort of super sheikh, super father, this sort of excess of patronymy that he imposed. That seems to be a male thing to me.
Have things improved at all? We heard about just a few hours of electricity every day. Is there more electricity? Is the water better?
I haven't been in Baghdad for a while now, and I think things are a little bit better, but not much, as far as I understand it. And it goes hand in hand, like everything, with security. And the security is a little bit better, but it's still very insecure. Not many of my friends, my Iraqi friends, have gone back. There are all sorts of complications about where you can live and what neighborhood and so forth. There's still car bombings, there's still assassinations, there's still a lot of gunfire and strange things. And so although, as I understand it, there are sort of civic programs, you know, that are beginning to put in sewage pipes and electricity pylons and do that kind of repair, you're starting from a very ground level of almost zero.
Even though this is a country that had a pretty sophisticated infrastructure before the invasion.
Well, I mean, electricity was pretty bad before, too.
Wendell Stevenson, Steavenson. Her book, The Weight of a Mustard Seed, An Iraqi General's Moral Journey During the Time of Saddam. It's published by Collins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.